I don't know if you have the daring to play Monopoly at Christmas with your family. Are you that brave? If indeed we wish to test our family unit in that way, there comes a point for me where enough is enough. There's a quite normal pattern of collusion, occasionally downright cheating amongst my other siblings. My eldest sister is particularly guilty. Extortion is not uncommon. And these things have led in the past to what has certainly felt like appropriate action on my own behalf, a direct physical response with a sweeping move of an arm, an upturning of the board, a destruction of the game. Vengeance is mine, declares Nathan. I'm hoping I'm not alone in this struggle, and I'm not the only one to have responded in such a delightfully endearing, if not a little childish, way. And actually, I don't want to implant my own childish actions into this thought, but I just get a sense as we get to chapter 34, chapter 35, the two that we're considering really this morning, that actually that Isaiah is effectively saying to us, enough is enough. There's a sense of exasperation, or that's at least what I pick up in the poetry of these two chapters. The watchword of these chapters is doom, or at least in chapter 34 it is. It's connected very much to the word desolation. And if there's something that's worse than that, it's the worst word, chaos. If you remember from last week, we spoke about the ways in which we measured ourselves up to justice and righteousness. Here was the plumb line and the measuring line of God in that way, that it was justice and righteousness. And we understood in looking at that measuring line and that plumb line that these were kind of bracketed with love, that actually the summary word for these things that were love, that actually we could see ourselves and measure ourselves up to love in that right way. But here the language has changed again, and there's this lovely thing in Isaiah of juxtaposition that Isaiah seems to enjoy putting and changing his language, mixing his metaphors, but if only just to give us the seriousness of the situation. And he's changed his measuring line and plumb line in chapter 35, and it was only in 33 that we read a very different response last week. Well, so firstly, the plumb line of desolation, we will compare to this language of righteousness. They're polar opposites, aren't they? Isn't the difference between desolation and righteousness a complete pole apart? If righteousness, or righteousness is the act of good, acting well, acting good, acting according to God's purpose, then isn't desolation then something which speaks about emptiness and destruction and the way of death? Isn't it the opposite to that? The measuring line of chaos then, I think we can actually see as the opposite to that of justice, though perhaps less easily seen in this case. Justice, in one sense, is the correct ordering of society, making sure that society itself and God's justice above those things is everything in its right place, with God at the head and everything else subscribing to God in one sense or another, making sure that the weak and the vulnerable are tended to, making sure that everything is in its place. We've said often, and this is the way that Augustine describes sin, is that sin is disordered love, that we love something more than God, which I think is a helpful picture for us. So therefore, justice is, in one sense, about that ordering of society, and chaos, therefore, we can see as the opposite. But I think the interesting thing here is that the word that's used, chaos, in the Hebrew, is actually the same word that describes God's creation before he begins to order it. that actually in the beginning of creation there was disorder, and part of that beautiful poetic passage at the very beginning of Genesis, we see God ordering creation into the way that it should be. We see this wonderful picture of God separating the heavens from the earth, of separating light from darkness, of separating the land from the waters, of doing this ordering process, and then establishing humanity within that ordered creation in order to help with that ordering of creation. And it is that exact same word. So in one sense, what Isaiah is describing here is a backward step to before anything was as it should be. Because you look at the way that God describes his creation as good at the end of that. At the end of his creation, he says God looked on all that he created and he said that it was good. So this descent back to chaos, and in this, and I think that's part of the language that we're using here, it is only just a path of destruction. So we've moved from, you can see how exasperated the language is here, that it's moved from looking towards the positives of a measuring line of justice and righteousness to the language of desolation and destruction and chaos. I don't think we necessarily think of chaos in that way as a destructive force, but actually I think it's right that we see it in that way, and therefore understand what responsibility we have to that beauty of creation which orders his creation, that intricate order. The judgment, again, we're still in chapter 34 here, really. The judgment then contains two further elements which justify comment before we then get to the antidote, which is beautiful in chapter 35. Firstly, that the imagery of desolation that is cast against the nations and Edom more specifically is that there will be total destruction, that everything needs to be wiped away. And then using the language of the natural world and these fantastic beasts, there will be the conquest of a rather strange group of animals. We were talking at our preaching team meeting this week, thinking about the weeks ahead, and it was pointed out that we hadn't mentioned much in terms of the beautiful and different voices that Isaiah uses. And here is a stark way that we'll see. Last week we had the language of shipping and galleys in terms of not being able to get into Jerusalem. And then here we have this language of human nature and the natural world. It's wonderful how Isaiah poetically picks up all of these different images to help us understand and to talk to a breadth of people in society. But here he chooses the language of the natural world. I think something that resonates with us probably most dramatically. I don't know if you've caught up with the second series of Blue Planet, but I don't know, have anybody been watching that with the new David Attenborough? I think that sort of thing resonates with us deeply, in that we see within the created world the glory of God. And again, if you saw that first episode, you will have seen dolphins surfing. Have you ever seen a dolphin surf? And it is thought that they only surf for sheer joy, which I thought was a wonderful thing, that God has installed joy into the life of a dolphin in that way, that they choose to do it because it's fun and it brings out with them. That's the scientist's best thought, is that a dolphin surfs because of joy. And isn't that brilliant? But I think this language of natural world helps us and brings us into some of these places. But it's a strange collection here, isn't it? Hedgehogs and hawks, you don't often hear those in the same sentences. But there's something very specific about these animals, in that they are all unclean. That's why Isaiah has chosen them, that these are all unclean animals according to the Jewish law. These are not fit for human consumption. They are not to be animals that are kept by humans. Now, that's not to say that they are disgusting, because I think there's some, you know, who could think a hedgehog was disgusting? You've seen those cute pictures of them. Who could think a hawk was disgusting? They're some of the most majestic beasts in creation. But yet these are unclean animals. And what the prophet here is saying, that where there were things that are of chaos, where there has been ordained a system and a pattern of things that are just destructive, that are leading to a way of death, everything will be wiped out. But coming in, sweeping in and taking over that picture will be creation. And although these are unclean, which means that this is a place unfit for human habitation, this is God taking his territory back still. Because God still possesses the hedgehog and the hawk. God still possesses these animals, these unclean animals that are mentioned in this passage. Falcons, owls, all of the like. But this is also about God reordering creation. This is also about God putting things back right and about God creating a new start, new things, doing something different with territory that has been defiled by humanity. Secondly, within just trying to round off chapter 34, and it's nice to have this opportunity to put these two chapters together, because I've only got two chapters to look at this week, where it's been at least six previously before this. But in this chapter is the language of vengeance. And really, just a little footnote at this point, and we'll build on it just a little later on, but a footnote to that language being used here is that I think in our understanding, the word vengeance is particularly harsh. I doubt that anybody here this morning, in terms of trying to translate the word vengeance, is thinking of anything positive. Am I right that vengeance itself has this negative connotation? And actually, I think in our minds, it's absolutely about revenge, that there's something vindictive about that word vengeance as we understand it. And I just want to say that I don't think that that's how we understand it from the original Hebrew. That I don't think that's how we understand it in terms of how the Jewish people have held on to it. You look at some of the, and you can do this when you get home, but you can do a little word search on Bible Gateway or something like that and look at the word vengeance and look at the context that it's often put in. Now, I'm not going to deny that at this place it looks very much about revenge, that this is about the vengeance of God and about something changing. But within the word vengeance is this element of things being restored to equality. Now, I think when you put that in the hands of God, that actually it becomes a much more positive word, that we don't necessarily have to see that language of vindication and revenge and violence that we often do. Actually, what I think we see is actually justice being restored, because vengeance is, and look at the dictionary definitions, is about restoring parity, about making sure that things are level and equal again. Now, of course, in some cases, that's going to involve somebody taking the brunt of that, or somebody losing something that they had gained, or something like that. But all I want to say is that there is something in this word of rebuilding and restoration back to the way things should be. So when we read this word vengeance, and when we declare God's vengeance within this, we're not necessarily just seeing that kind of the violence and anger and fury of God, though that might be within there, but we are actually seeing that sense of things being made equal again, that there is something here about restoration as well as sometimes fury, rage, those kind of things. I just thought that that was helpful to point out. And again, particularly as you look at that language within the context of the Psalms, that the examples are that they it seems to be that the Jewish people are celebrating, that the psalmists are celebrating God's vengeance. Well, if that was to do with violence, I just don't think that that would be the case. So see it in that way. So I felt it was worth exploring the relative darkness of chapter 34, if only to highlight the balm and joy then that we receive within chapter 35. We receive even these first words of the chapter with great anticipation. because everything has been so desolate up to this point. And if you followed this series through, there's been a lot of tough weeks in order to bring out what's going on in these chapters. There's been a lot of violence. There's been a lot of language of destruction. And so even these words in 35, as we're coming to the end of this series, looking up to chapter 39, feels like just something much more beautiful, much more precious, much more words of hope directly to us, rather than trying to search for them amongst some of the difficult words. But even in this, in these first words, it's about desert and wilderness. That's the language that Isaiah brings in, but it's also about the juxtaposition that he then puts there for us. Just a beautiful poetic device. The desert and the parched land will be glad. The wilderness will rejoice and blossom. Like the crocus, it will burst into bloom. Here within these words are a picture of God and the display of his splendor. It reminded me very much of the words of Isaiah 61, which brings out these pictures of beautiful oaks as a display of splendor for God's righteousness. But here it's the picture of a small crocus. But if you picture a crocus in the context of a desert, well, that becomes the most beautiful and precious thing, because it means a whole number of things, doesn't it? It means, first of all, that within God there is potential beyond what we see. That there is a chance that something can grow where we have declared it barren. It means that there is water. It means that there is living water, even down in the depths. And sometimes, though we can't see it, it doesn't mean it's not there. Despite our sight and beyond our understanding, life can be found within barren places. You need to know that for your walk with God. That though things on the surface can just seem the most barren, they can seem the most empty. I don't know if you've ever experienced the long dark night of the soul. I don't know if you've ever experienced the desolation of just not being able to feel or sense anything of God's presence. It happens to us within the Christian experience. But yet the words here are a declaration which say that whatever your experience, whatever you can see, whatever you perceive in front of you, that there is hope. There can be life in barren places. And how do we know that? How is it proved beyond this? Well, it's proven in the empty tomb, isn't it? Don't we see this great story from Jesus? Don't we know, and haven't we learnt, that from his power over death, that his victory over the grave, that we can have the absolute confidence that even when we see death around us, even when we see decay around us, that there can be life, that there will be life, that there is hope because of Jesus Christ. And I think we can add to that picture this morning from these words of Isaiah, these prophetic words, which say that even in the desert place, a crocus can burst into life. Even in a desert and a parched land, there can be water, there can be living, there can be life. And actually then, things are taken on, aren't they? From that picture of the desert and the wilderness, the picture is developed onto something of physiology and physicality. Those who, again, who have been declared unclean, because that's the reality of the law, those with physical defect, those who were suffering because of anything from a physical point of view. And I'm quite sure here that we also see language of anxiety and distress. Look at the language then that is used. Look at the language that is declared to people in that position, to those who have been declared unclean according to the law, to those who have been who have suffered in some way. What does the prophet say? He says, be strong. Do not fear. Verse 3, strengthen the feeble hands, steady the knees that give way. Say to those with fearful hearts, be strong. Do not fear. Your God will come. Isn't that great? And the reason that we are then underpinned this is because it says your God will come. He will come with vengeance. But again, let's see that as restoring something equal. With divine retribution, he will come to save you. Be strong, do not fear, your God will come. Just wonderful words of hope and of salvation. The language of the chapter, with all this juxtaposition of hope in dark places of life, in barren places of healing to that which was lame, all of this culminates in the language of homecoming, which to the people of God at the right time would have been the source of just greatest joy, because rooted in their experience, in their national mentality, is this language of exile in Egypt. Rooted in their history is this sense of we don't have our land, we are a slave people. That's rooted into the mentality of the Hebrew people, particularly at this time. They'd suffered exile again at the hands of other superpowers, and the tragic element of this beginning of Isaiah is that this is spoken to a people who will go again into exile. That a superpower will take them over, will displace them from their own land, and will take them and coerce them in all sorts of different ways to a different language, to idolatry and all sorts. That's the language of Isaiah. That's the words that Isaiah, that's the context that Isaiah is speaking into. That they will be taken over. So therefore, look at this language of homecoming. Look at what it would mean to a people who have that mentality and that threat to them, that you will have your land to dwell in, that the joy at coming home is one of recognizing safety and security, of knowing where you belong. I don't know how you feel when you come home from holiday. The thing that I'm often most grateful for is my own sofa. Because on my own sofa, I know how it feels underneath my bottom. It's a safe place, it's a secure place, it's a place that I understand, and actually there's great joy in just sitting in your place. In the place where you belong, in the context where you belong with my cat and everything else that surrounds me. There's great joy in that, isn't there? But again, if you look into the context of these people and say, well, this isn't just about a home to live in, this is about a land. This is about familiarity and safety and security and the joy at coming home. Still within this language is the language of prodigals. About the joy of someone coming home after they've been away a long time and done all sorts of things. But Isaiah includes in this sense of homecoming, this feeling of joy that's being expressed here at being safe and secure and pouring all these things. He talks of a road, which is such common biblical language for good things that will come. It'll only be in a few weeks that we think about John the Baptist preparing the way in our mentality as we journey through Advent again. And the words that are used there are, again, a quote, and it's about a highway being prepared for the Lord, a flat and a smooth and a straight highway for God coming in to our existence. But here the language is of the way of holiness. A firm, flat, and direct path back to doing things right. And there's a helpful rule for the road, which will hopefully help us in the most practical way. Here are the rules for the road. We need them, don't we, so that we don't crash. And they're quite simple in this case. Firstly, the road is for that which is clean, meaning that there's an obligation towards purity in the ritual and practical sense. And remember that although we do not measure ourselves up to the law in that exact same way, we look to the words of Jesus, who ordained that love be the greatest measure of our activity. We go back to some of the things that we looked at last week. So love being the greatest measure of our activity, and so therefore cleanliness, which in this case we can easily equate to godliness, in that it's all about living a life of love, which involves grace and forgiveness and mercy and justice. So the first rule for the road is that it's towards purity, righteousness, cleanliness. Secondly, and again, this is all spoken about in the negative, but I'm giving this the positive spin. Secondly, the road is for the wise, meaning that we've got to remove ourselves from stupidity, which sounds like the most obvious statement in the world, but I think sometimes we're in the position where we know exactly what we should do. I rarely meet anybody pastorally, actually, where people are just don't know what to do, really. I think often we know exactly what we need to do. I think often we know exactly the choices that we need to make. And yet, we find that sometimes the things that we know that we should do just the most difficult things. There's a famous quote, "Stupidity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting the same result. Ignorance is not caring." Sorry, expecting a different result, isn't it? I've written that down wrong. Stupidity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result. Too often we know intimately what we need to do to make a situation right. And too often we feel ill-equipped or unable to do that which we know is right. Wisdom in this case is perhaps seeing and understanding those things and actually learning to act outside of your own strength in order to act upon God's purposes and in His strength. So firstly, the road is for the clean. Secondly, the road is for the wise. Thirdly, the road is for the redeemed. What the prophet says. To be one of the redeemed means we are one of those who has accepted that we haven't always done things right, who has refused to let the situations of life define the future, and one who has been able to look beyond the tragedy of human existence and experience and be able to declare, "Blessed be your name." If only we would learn to make our lives a song of redemption. And in that way, a declaration of our God who is bigger than our problems. Lastly, the road is for the rescued or ransomed. Here is an invitation from God to the greatest joy, that you have been chosen, that you have been accounted for. Your dent in the pot of sin has been atoned for. And you have been invited to have a seat at the banqueting table. At that table there is feasting, and there is no sign of famine. And at that table there is the greatest of joy, and it's that feeling of coming home because that's where you belong. The road is for the redeemed and the rescued and the ransomed. And friends, there's no place like home. No place like the presence of our God. No comfort like that which we find at the Father's feet. No contentment like hearing His voice. no peace like that which he gives. And so today I pray that as we feast in a literal sense, that gladness, just as the prophet says, that gladness and joy would overtake you. Isn't that beautiful language? That even this morning, whatever we bring into this place, whatever the world looks like for us, that this morning that we would be overtaken with joy and gladness, and that your acquaintance with sorrow and sighing, even if it's just for a moment, would be taken away. So friends, may we walk in that way of holiness. May we know that joy just this morning. Amen. Before we feast, we will sing, "Blessed be your name." Let's stand together as we sing.